Welcome, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 7. Now, before we begin, of course, we must not forget that we are living and working on Skrempukulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of Skrempik people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve the situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Today, our guest on Food Conversations is Liz Blakeway, director of the Land to Table Network, a nonprofit organization centered in the North Okanagan, with a broad goal of helping create a thriving, healthy, just, and resilient regional food system in this part of the province, all of which are extraordinarily laudable goals. Welcome, Liz, to Food Conversations.
Thanks for having me.
It's a delight to have you. We had a wonderful conversation before the show today and all sorts of things to come out, one of which was that your husband is Darren Anderson, the at one time solar panel and arrangement array installer who was on the board of the Shuswap Solar Energy Society, which is now no longer with us, but did some good work when it was doing it.
Yeah.
And you live, putting your home where your heart is, in a hybrid straw bale house. I'm going to ask you what hybrid straw bale is in a moment.
That's
in White Lake, in what you call 3 acres of paradise, the other paradise in your home, in your life. And we'll talk about the other paradise
You're
later.
You're reading my bio online.
I am reading
you?
Your bio online. That's the way it goes around here. Oh, no secrets. And the family, your husband's family had purchased a property in 2009, and so they're there in the same place, and
That sounds
like a wonderful thing. So tell listeners a little bit about that home of yours.
Wow, okay, that's a good start. Well, I feel very privileged to also live in Shuquemakulu. We are on 3 acres in what is known as White Lake, and feel very lucky and privileged to have landed there. We, my husband, Darren's parents, bought the property, like you said, in 2009. And in 2013, when I was on maternity leave, they had it up for sale. So we spent a couple of months up there and thought, oh my goodness, this place is so special and so beautiful. If we let them sell it, we'll never get anything like this back again
in our family. So you made them an offer they couldn't refuse.
Well, it allowed them to stay there too. They didn't actually want to leave, but they felt torn. So we had this discussion about, well, this house, this old farmhouse on the site, maybe not be suitable for our growing family. Can we afford to buy in and build a house? And my sister and her partner happened to be visiting that weekend, and they said, this sounds really interesting to us too. And so then began a journey of co-ownership and co-building a house. Darren always wanted to build straw bale. He's super interested in natural building materials, as am I. And so there you have it. We built a straw bale home. He was the, we're owner builders. He was the construction manager.
They say that the rules in the when you're outside the municipality for regional districts are fairly open to not whatever you want to do, but you have more leeway sometimes.
Well, and at the time we built, there was no building inspections in that electoral area. So there you go.
Well timed.
I'd
of course,
say.
Well built. Of course.
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of strong qualities to straw bale homes.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, one of the people in town here is building a straw bale home.
Right.
And been doing it on her own for quite a long time. And it's a slow process, but she's getting there. And it's she also is very proud of it. She thinks it's a wonderful way to sort of reach back into past behaviors, but also to use modern technologies where they are helpful.
Yeah, I feel grateful every day for my house. I really do.
Now, in the middle of all this,
with
obviously a setup for family suppers and that kind of thing, you are also working hard at rebuilding local food systems and systems that we have lost and helping to kind of shunt aside systems that aren't working very, very well anymore. Why don't you talk about that two-way street, one door open to leave, the other door open to come in.
Okay. Gosh, where to begin there? So Land to Table wasn't Land to Table when I first began, but I had heard through a farmer friend who I'd worked with in North Vancouver about this group that was beginning around a kitchen table through a study circle to better understand how to support local farmers.
How did that number, you know how many people there were, how did they get together like that. I mean, kitchen tables are everywhere and there's lots of people who could sit at them, but...
Well, they were all from farming families and connected through farming families relatively locally. So one was an existing farmer, one was a student trying to start a master's degree. She was the one who was doing the sustainable development diploma through SFU. Part of her task was to develop a study circle. So she brought these different generations of women together.
She was the mole who kind of got you
she
all
She really
together.
Was. She was the founder of Land to Table. That's Evelina Lang, who also happens to be the executive director of Organic BC now. So there you go.
That's gone on to an excellent career.
Yeah.
What would the system have been that you were trying to move out and replace with a locally sourced system?
Well, I think that present tense, we are still trying to do this, but I would say... the global food system is one of these systems that we are trying to not move out, because in order to be resilient...
Some bits of pieces can be kept.
That's right. You need duplication. We need to be able to access global food in times when we can't get local, and local in times when we can't get global.
That's right.
But the global food system doesn't really care about relationships and doesn't really care about our small and medium scale farmers locally.
Absolutely. And the system that is to be put in its place is one where... local small to medium farmers are central.
That's
right.
They
play a central role rather than being peripheral.
Yeah, they're able to have thriving businesses, and they're able to grow their businesses because they're able to access multiple different markets, not just farmers markets.
There's a concept that you've talked about, and it's very much part of Land to Table, and that's the notion of collaboration. Mm. And I know it's a general kind of principle. Why don't you animate that principle a little bit? For listeners.
Okay. Let me see if I can do this justice. I think as a network organization, we believe that working together in collaboration and in partnership is both an inspiring model for catalyzing change in response to complex issues, but probably the only way to address change to complex issues at a local level.
You can't do it alone. You do it better when there's kind of a group energy.
Yeah. And what we found in the North Okanagan was that there was a lot of duplication happening. People were spinning their wheels because everyone was trying to do similar things at the same time by themselves. Mm-hmm. There's not enough funding. There's not enough energy. and so being able to work as a network, being able to work collaboratively in relationship, understand the different needs and priorities of our sectors, makes things work better.
I find as a physician, talking to somebody on the phone who's in another community is one thing, but seeing them face to face and having a group of people sharing concerns is so much more powerful.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, at the beginning, one of the places that Land to Table turned to was ironically, the BC Centre for Disease Control for a framework on food security.
Yeah.
And I made it my business to look this little notion up. And I was really quite struck because there, obviously, everybody thinks of the BC Centre for Disease Control with reference to the pandemic and sort of some degree of preventive practice, but they're very focused. But this was not only talking about food security in lots of different ways, but also talking about things like structural inequity.
Yeah.
And structural inequity is a phrase... Why don't you explain what structural inequity...
Oh, you're going to let me explain that, are you?
I am. Well, I think because it's central to what you're doing with Land to Table.
Yeah, okay. Let's see. Let's see if I can do this. So I think it all relates back to the systems that we have in place, the systems that are breaking these relationships and connections to each other.
And sometimes they're just unfair.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess... if you want to go there, we could go back to how Canada was founded.
Indeed.
And how we came to rely on agriculture as a key economy in our country as a result of displacing Indigenous people from their land.
I just read a paper on energy written from an Indigenous perspective. And all the way through, they said, so-called Canada.
Yeah.
And it kept on reminding me that we put the name on the land that had already been inhabited for a very long time by human beings just like us.
That's right.
And had named lots of things, including the general countryside, but also lots of features, land features, because they're connected to the land.
Right.
They talk about, the Center for Disease Control talks about lots of different ways in which the system has biases that exclude people. Mm-hmm. And the obvious ones are race, gender, class, sexual orientation, and other domains, as they say in a general mm-hmm. term. But it really is something that when we address it, it starts to enrich the system, a system, in this case, the food system, the food production system.
Yeah.
If everybody's involved, then you get a stronger system.
That's right. One of the things that we're trying to do at Land to Table, more so this year, is draw the connection between growing the local food economy and improving our community food security. So we think that we can't have community food security if we don't have strong and vibrant small and medium scale farmers, like I said, who have access to markets. And so one of the things we're trying to do is connect our local food growers to our local social service agencies to ensure that the people who are hungry or the people who don't have access to nutritious food can be connected to their local farmers as well.
Another thing that's part of this notion of food security is a very strong emphasis from the CDC on Indigenous food sovereignty, which is also a way of looking at the relationship with land, that you don't exploit the land, you collaborate or cooperate with the forces that animate the land.
Yeah.
And that was really quite striking to me. There's a whole sort of paragraph in considerable detail, and they even talk about colonial systems need, this is reading off their document, colonial systems need to be restructured to better support Indigenous food sovereignty, and the responsibility for this rests with non-Indigenous people who need to go through an ongoing process of unlearning current ways of thinking and relearning based on the values and practices that guide Indigenous people's relationship to land and to each other. And that to me is like a central pivotal point of what's going on. Just remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Liz Blakeway, who is the director of the Land to Table Network. So let's shift gears a little bit away from these sort of somewhat abstract notions we've been talking about and focus a little bit on a compare and contrast process for you, something that you are the only person in the world who can do this, and that is comparing and contrasting Trail BC to Johnson's Landing BC, two very different places that both played an important role in your life.
That's right.
So first of all, life in Trail. The Consolidated Mining and Smelting Company of Canada, or Cominco, which later became Teck, Canada's largest mining company, also involved with the oil sands, coal, and has just bought the Kimberley Sun Mine, which is a big solar display in Kimberley. Obviously, they're hedging their bets along the line of system change. They're they're reading the entrails of our society. You told me that when we were talking about this, you said, well, the Trail smoke eaters.
That's right.
Duh. Yeah. And I thought, oh my goodness, I never thought of them as people taking in those toxic plumes. Anyway, at one point, in fact, your school was shut down because there was an inversion and there was a toxic plume, and it made for an interest. Well, they locked the doors and windows and kept you inside.
That's right, yeah.
And you used to get tested for lead every year.
Yeah.
So this is Trail. It's a company town in which Teck has done one or two things that people are not proud of, dumping tailings into the Columbia River on a regular basis. But it has 11,000 people working for it, including some of your family members. But the owners don't live there. They're in another part of the world. What was Trail to you? You're a child growing up there, so it's a totally different experience from all this, stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting to reflect on living in Trail through eyes of other people as an adult who hadn't been there before and say, oh my goodness, Trail is a wild place. There's this smelter right in the middle of town and it's so loud and there's this giant smokestack. But when you grow up there, you don't see that. You don't notice it on a day-to-day basis. It kind of blends into the background.
Part of the furniture.
And I think when I was sharing about growing up, I also reflected on the fact that I had a really beautiful and wonderful childhood. You know, Trail's a small town. We got on our bikes Saturday morning and disappeared for the day.
Where did you go?
We went to the parks. We just went to the park. I think we park hopped. we climbed up the mountain near our house. I was outside. I was outside in nature all the time. So growing up in Trail was interesting because there was also this weight to it. Like you said, my blood was tested for right. toxic levels of lead on an annual basis. Our backyard was remediated, which means they took the soil away to replace it with clean soil so that we as children didn't get lead poisoning. Like those things. And then, as you said, we were brought inside at recess one day from school because there was a plume of smoke coming down the river towards us.
Yes.
It sounds all very...
And what was your experience then as a child in the school with all the doors and windows locked?
Yeah, I don't, like, I have this image of being in the field and kind of looking out toward the river before we got brought in and kind of thinking, oh, well, I don't really see anything. Like, I don't see the danger.
They're getting upset over nothing.
I think it was
I would rather play.
Yeah, right. I think it was probably exciting to some extent, but it was like, what's, you know, that niggly feeling in the back of your mind. Like, what's happening here?
The adults seem to be upset.
Right.
Must be something
What's
going.
Wrong?
Yes,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned that there was another paradise besides the place you're living in right now.
Yeah.
And that other paradise is Johnson's Landing, which had come into your family. You can maybe describe that process a bit, but a very different place.
A very different place. So Johnson's Landing, for those who don't know, is in the Kootenays. It's quite remote. It was about a three-hour drive from Trail. It's past Caslow, BC. So the north, up and around the north end of Kootenay Lake. It's the furthest point you can drive to. My mom's family were one of the first or one of the early families to homestead there, along with Elgit Johnson. And they
whose name has been lent to Johnson's Landing.
That's right. Yeah, right. who just happened upon this place one day when he was out on
a rowboat.
It was
a bench above the lake, right?
That's right. It's a bench above the lake. And so they cleared land to grow food because that's what you did when you were a settler. So my mom's dad's family came with a portion of the 12 children that would eventually be up there, the McNichol family. of which there's a road still named after up at Johnson's Landing, McNichol Road. And it was a really special place. There was always lots of family around. There was always lots of food being grown. They raised cattle. We pressed apple juice.
So it was a big bench.
It was a big bench, yeah. A big enough bench.
Yes, big enough.
We were at the base of Kootenay Joe Mountain, an indigenous man well-known in that area. And I got to explore this really pristine, remote wilderness.
How did you do that? Did you wander off into the woods?
I did wander off a bit. It wasn't without hesitation. But, you know, our parents weren't necessarily concerned. We had instructions, but we wandered off. Often we had a dog with us, so that helped.
And the traffic was light.
There was no... Yeah, right. Exactly. We had a couple of moments running into locals in random fern fields, but other than that, yeah, it was very free.
What did the mood for you, what was the mood you were in when you were there, say, compared to the mood in Trail? I mean, they are different places, but you're a child looking at it from fresh eyes.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, like, the first thing that came to my mind was the smell, actually. Like, I think, I want to say clean. I don't think that quite does it justice, but I just remember, like, the dichotomy is pristine versus not.
There was a big flood, a big debris flow in 2012. Did that have any effect on your parents, grandparents' home?
So the family farm had been sold. My mom's brother was running the family farm for a long time, which... It's very isolated up there. So he eventually made the very hard decision to sell. We had a little cabin up there for a few more years after and sold. My parents made, again, the very hard decision to sell that just a few years before the landslide. But that landslide killed people we know. So,
yes.
It was very devastating.
Yeah, I read a piece about it and it looked like everybody was shocked and dismayed because it was way bigger than anybody thought it should be. And it overlapped the gully ridges and stuff and did things that were not expected by anybody.
Yeah.
You're working on sort of regenerating the way we grow food to make it more sustainable and more connected to natural values and the land. Can you, in your mind, see any connectivity between the way you would feel when you went to Johnson's Landing and the way you feel, obviously, in the home you live in now, but also the work you do? Because it seems like there's a common current.
Yeah, that's right. Gosh, how do I answer that question?
You should just muse.
Just muse about, yeah. I think, I mean, like I said, the word dichotomy comes up. It's like there seemed to be an injustice in the fact that as a child, my blood had to be tested for toxic levels of lead. Later, as an adult, I found out that I had heavy metals in my body that were impacting
when you were in Australia.
Health. Yeah, we were living in Australia.
It took a long time for that to come to the surface.
Yeah.
And you'd been to doctors over a number of years who either didn't have a clue about what was going on or kind of dismissed.
That's right.
You know, young woman, yes, sure, you know, having problems with her period or whatever, you know, some kind of.
Yeah, it was very dismissive.
Right.
And that, I think, connects back to systems as well. But yeah, I was sharing with you that before the show that I had some pretty big health issues that nobody mm-hmm. wanted to help me address. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to find this fantastic doctor when living in Australia. But it all comes back to the fact that my grandfather worked in the arsenic plant at Cominco. Arsenic is not, you don't get rid of that. You have to purposely try and get rid of arsenic.
So did you have a course of chelation therapy to remove it?
Through a series of different supplements.
Yeah, that's the way a lot of heavy metals can be removed.
Right.
You have to deliberately remove them. You don't just wait for them to go away on their own.
That's right.
They do abate, but it takes 30 years, I suppose, and you feel crummy in the meantime.
Yeah.
So we kind of touched a little bit on travel, because travel became and has been part of your life at a number of times, and education. And it's interesting how many people who are involved in very hands-on work with regard to the food system, who have, as you do, several degrees and certificates, which is a way of kind of legitimizing what you're doing. If somebody's skeptical, and you can say, well, I got a degree, so settle down.
I suppose. I don't know if I feel. I think I'd like to think we're beyond the point in time where the experts are the ones who are solving these problems for us.
I wish we were, but I know that whenever I say to somebody that I'm a physician, I know there's going to be a reaction.
Yeah.
And it's, there's, you
the
just have to kind of
we live in.
Roll with it. So the first part was a couple of years at Selkirk College.
Yeah.
And there was a real reason why you went to Selkirk College.
That's right. My mom worked at Selkirk College for years, like 30 plus years.
What was she doing there?
She was an administrator. Mm-hmm. She worked in a number of different departments. Mm. Toward the end, she was working for the Renewable Resources Department and the Nursing Department. And so fond of the people that she worked with. Mm. It was like a nice community of folks there. So it just so happened that I got free tuition because my mom worked there.
Nothing
so
wrong with that.
I feel now, at the time, I felt kind of like I was being left behind because my friends had gone away to university and I stayed locally. But, you know, I'm really grateful for that time. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think being there allowed me to find a path into environmental sciences and environmental communication and behavior change. That
it was called an integrated environmental program.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Integrated environmental planning. That's right. Yeah, it was all very interdisciplinary. We did a ton of hands-on things, a ton of field work. We did lots of plant identification, which, you know, you might think is not.
You found out all those plants that you'd been wandering on in Johnson's Landing and seeing, and now you knew what they were.
Right. And some other purposes.
And did you have lunch with your mom?
And I would have lunch with my mom. Yeah, it was really special.
I would think you'd have to do that. She knew everybody and she was obviously your mom.
She was very proud. She loved that I was there. Yeah, that was really nice. Yeah.
Now, after that, then you moved on to further education. And the place you chose also was a matter of some convenience for you.
Yeah.
That's Royal Roads,
yeah.
Royal University. What happened there and what drew you there initially? Obviously, you had some really good experiences too.
Yeah, so I took a year off between Selkirk College and Royal Roads and did some travel and then came back. And it was handy that they accepted all of my credits from Selkirk College and I could complete my degree in a 12-month program. But the thing I loved about Royal Roads, which I think is the thing that I love about my current job, is it was interdisciplinary. Mm. It wasn't just one focus. It was understanding how things connect and the different people you can work with to address problems and create solutions.
I'll remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Liz Blakeway, who's the director of the Land to Table Network. Now, Liz, when you were at Royal Roads, you also were involved in very much getting out in the field and seeing what was, it wasn't a classroom-based program.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we did it again. We did lots of field work and lab work. I can remember collecting crabs on the beach because this was in, what is it, Souk area, Langford area. Yeah. But then also I remember engaging with a group of children who we had invited into the lab and we were responsible for teaching. Like I remember being out in community and presenting on environmental issues as a part of our communications course. Like it was really a fantastic opportunity.
Do you remember the part or any one or a couple of things that really stood out for you in what you were learning both at Selkirk and at Royal Roads? What were the currents flowing in you about that?
I think one of the things I remember thinking about was how valuable it was to have that hands-on level, like to be out in the field and know how difficult field work can be. Mm-hmm. But then also to be engaged or have an, but have a really important reason to be engaging because your grade depended on it, to be engaging with the community, and that how important it was to be able to communicate in plain language, which I don't think I'm very good at yet, about
our listeners will disagree with you
about environmental issues.
It's interesting you said is how difficult it is to do research. It's kind of like the reductionist system that we have where you want to have one variable and change it and not have the other variables change. In natural systems, all sorts of variables change.
Yeah.
And yet what you learn as a person is how complex they are. So what you lose on the detail and precision end of the swing, yeah, you gain on this insight and understanding.
I'm glad you said the word complex because I think part of like what you might call our theory of change at Lanta Table is understanding that the systems we're working within are complex. And the only way, when you're working in complex systems, the experts aren't going to be the ones to give you the answer. Like that, we know that we have to come together. We have to make sense together. And then the only thing we can do is make the next right step from there together.
It's a step towards maturity, the way I would see it. You know, like we're not just simpletons. We're complex people too.
Yeah.
That's right. I mentioned travel as well as education is two things that happened. Where did you travel between Selkirk and Royal Roads?
Oh, I did. I think what was a common loop at the time, it was Southeast Asia. So I think most of the countries, Malaysia, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and then down to New Zealand for 3 months. I was traveling with a great girlfriend who I grew up with. We rented a car, traveled around New Zealand for 3 months and surfed and camped, and then over to Australia, where we kind of did the bus loop up the East Coast.
What do you remember, what struck you as you were traveling from one country and culture to another?
Oh, gosh. I think it was probably complete overwhelm. Like, because it was so different and so vibrant. I think probably I see colors. Like, when you ask that question, color comes to mind.
Like tropical birds, but also the experience.
Yeah. And I think probably also a feeling of insignificance. Like there's a lot of people in this world and they're all just living their lives.
And they sometimes live very different lives and you didn't even know they existed.
That's
before.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Well, having lived on both sides of this continent, people in the West don't know much about people in the East, yeah, and people in the East don't know much about the West. One of our friends who was French Canadian, Montreal, said he'd been out West. Why did I think he hadn't traveled? He'd been all the way to Toronto. Mm-hmm. Oh, golly, that's not quite there. Anyway, your next educational experience actually then you traveled again to Australia.
Yeah.
Darren was there doing a degree in renewable energy.
Yeah, that's and right. You, well, you know, I was just going to go and spend like a month
visit.
Or
yeah,
two.
Right.
And 3.5 years later, we moved back together. But that was a really wonderful time too, because I got to really like jump into my career. There were different opportunities there.
Yeah.
A lot better paying.
You were working there too.
I was working there. Yeah.
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 At a variety of different things.
Yeah.
Perth.
Yes. We lived in Perth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mining town. It's an interesting thread.
What was that like seeing another mining town?
Yeah. Well, it was very different, right? It was corporate mining. So we weren't like the mines were located very far flung distances from Perth.
Right.
Huge country, but corporate town, very well-paying jobs.
Yes, and that's one way to endear yourself to the community, pay the people who work for you a lot.
Well, right, yeah.
That's right. But you also took a few side trips. additional, or was that previously?
I traveled to China by myself for 6 weeks. I kind of had to leave because my visa was running out.
They have to renew it from outside the country.
That's right. But I mean, it was a trip I was planning anyway. Yeah. It was one of those like bucket list things. Like I wanted to travel by myself. I did Mandarin lessons for a number of months before I went, so I could like maybe barely scrape.
Did it work?
Scrape by.
Did it work?
You know, by the end of my trip there, I was able to understand some things.
Yeah.
But I could tell you my tongue hurt after Mandarin lessons. It's just such a different language, so different.
Mouth shape. How did Chinese people react to you being able to say a few words in their language?
Oh, with a laugh, with a chuckle, right?
But they kind of liked it.
I think they liked it. Yeah, I did a Yangtze River cruise, and I was bunking with a Chinese family. And they just thought I was ridiculous. There were three adult sisters and a brother all traveling together. Mm. And the one just pointed and laughed at me the whole time.
Were they laughing at you or kind of, I mean, was it derision or was it more like you really are amusing?
I think I was amusing. Some of the sisters would slap the one and tell her to stop making fun of me.
But they'd laugh too.
They were very kind. They shared the rice whiskey and some food.
So, back in the temperate climate of British Columbia,
yes. You
went on to another degree,
a
master's degree at Simon Fraser. Mm-hmm. What was the focus of that?
The focus of that was urban studies. So it wasn't specifically a planning degree. It was the way they described it. It was the why of planning, not the how.
Oh, dear me.
Right?
That's academia for you. You won't get a job out of that. I really know why we're doing it, but I haven't a clue how to do it.
Yeah, well, there was much of the how too. But my focus was really on waste management, waste reduction, behavior change.
And food in particular.
And food waste in particular. This connected back to my childhood, recycling was the trend of the 80s, right? That was the campaign when I was a child.
So you take your tin cans 20 miles to drop them off.
Heaven forbid my parents throw a tin can in the garbage, right? But also I think, connecting back to like the soil and the place I grew up, I cared a lot about the worms for some reason. So composting was something I was really interested in as a local action that anyone could do. I even got to the point where I was teaching vermi composting workshops for people who lived in Vancouver apartments.
You can buy worm droppings for a very large sum of money in a bag.
Yes.
Or you can just feed the worms in your own garden it works the same way.
If you have a garden, that's right. Yeah.
So food recycling and waste, food that was considered waste, recycling it into new soil.
Yeah. And I was looking at small scale composting in urban centers in particular. I think, again, as this like local action, like something we can do.
Was there something about, you said it was about the why, not about the how, but obviously, when you saw people doing this, you were learning the how on the job.
I was learning the how, but I was also learning the why of the why it wasn't working very well.
Oh.
Like why food waste? So I took, again, kind of coming back to that systems thinking, I was looking at what are the systems that are in place that allow us or don't allow us to recycle, in this case, compost our food waste. And so I was looking at the policy that affected that. We're at City of Vancouver, had the Greenest City Action Plan at the time. They banned food waste from entering landfill. But the product that was coming out of that wasn't actually very usable
by
farmers.
What?
The quality of it wasn't
really
that great.
Because
it was a large-scale system.
Oh, okay.
And there was a lot of different products going in there that you might not get in your backyard compost system.
Right.
And so I was looking at how do we connect small scale systems to urban farmers so that we're recycling food and the end product is usable.
One of the things that I've discussed with local organic community here is that there's a bit of a belief that when you compost food waste or any other kind of organic material, the agrochemicals in it will be destroyed by the composting process. Looking at it from a scientific point of view, reading up in the literature, it's not actually that case. Some pesticides, for example, are broken down, but some are not. It's just that it's very hard to get organic materials to make your compost out. a lot of organic farmers here use compost that comes from conventional farmers.
Oh,
that's right. You know, animal, you know, waste and that kind of thing. Yeah. They, because there's no choice. You know, we've set the system up. This is where we're talking again about changing one system and instituting another.
Yeah.
And relying on agrochemicals, which is a firm basis for much food that's imported into this country, is not the ideal way to go.
Well, perhaps not. Yeah. I mean, I think part of what drew me into this is I ended up working for the composting industry in Perth for some time, helping them figure out how to market their products, what their products were, how they were different, and how to kind of close that loop, I think, is what it came down to.
Now, when you were back in Canada, you also worked with the District of North Vancouver.
Yeah.
And you were doing a lot of this, what you're talking about now, you were doing a lot of that there too. How did you find a Canadian context?
What was interesting is, you know, we moved back to Canada partly because we wanted to be closer to family, but also because we thought Vancouver was like the mecca for sustainability. And I think we quickly found out that that wasn't necessarily the case. A lot of greenwashing.
Where was the gap? Where was the gap between execution and aspiration? What was the problem? Did you saw it?
I think there was a lot of talk, but not a lot of action on the ground, and you know, making a big deal of what they were doing instead of like what the actual impact was.
Right.
Whereas my experience in Perth was that people were just kind of getting on with it and figuring it out.
And Darren had his degree in renewable energy. And I know as he arrived up here, he was involved with installations of solar arrays and that kind of thing. Now, when you came up here, it was a bit of a sea change for you. And I thought we could talk a little bit more about the origin story of land to table. Because one of the things that the group of people sitting around the kitchen table were thinking was maybe somebody's done this before and we could learn to model ourselves. And the system or the direction that you turned in was a system established in Vermont. It was similar but different. Why don't we do a little bit of compare and contrast between Vermont and what happened here?
You bet. So the origin story as I know it is that this study circle was brought together and they were studying the Vermont farm to plate model.
Already. So this was academic participant who'd organized this.
That's right.
That was one of the things she was doing.
Yes.
I was going to ask you where it came from because people don't automatically say, oh, what should we do? Let's go to Vermont and see what they're doing.
Yeah, no. People don't just necessarily have study circles. Maybe some do.
It's called, by the way, the golden model, the gold standard now, but that wasn't necessarily the case at the beginning.
Well, and I think so what they were looking at in particular, they were looking at the structure. So this collective impact network of many different sectors coming together were able to achieve some pretty fantastic statistics over a period of time.
And they were supported from the beginning by the powers that be in Vermont.
Yeah.
I mean, when I read up on it, I was quite astonished. The governor, the Senate, and the House of Representatives in Vermont were all acting to promote, and it was they who created they established the statute in 2009, created the Farm to Plate Investment Program. And who invested in it? Well, who at a level of management, the Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility was one organization, Rural Vermont, another organization, the House Official Government Agriculture and Commerce Committee, and the Senate Agriculture and Economic Development Committee. That was all behind what was going in Vermont. It wasn't a bunch of citizen farmers sitting around a table in a kitchen.
True.
So it was, you were starting here, the program here was starting much more as a grassroots operation. So what ended up being the inspiration that you derived from Vermont?
Yeah, I think the catalyst, well, so I think it's worth saying the group, we picked and chose from that model what felt most applicable here. I think that network structure, like this idea that we could all come together around a common vision and goals as a way to take action was kind of key to that. Mm-hmm. The other thing was that central to that work in Vermont was that they had a paid coordinator helping to push this work along. Shocking, right? That might be what it takes.
Well, no, but I've seen organizations, and the day they really hit the map is when they pay somebody to be in the shop, as it were, answer questions if they come in. Yeah. It makes a huge difference.
It does. And I think what really captured the group, the founders of Land to Table, as they have become, was what Vermont was able to do for the local food economy, so for the local farmers. And so that's been central to Land to Table, supporting our small and medium-scale farmers.
Do something right in the field there. Remind listeners again that I'm speaking with Liz Blakeway, who's the director of the Land to Table Network. So given the fact that you didn't have the governor of, or the premier of British Columbia signing a document saying, we will support you, which maybe one day that will happen.
Maybe. We're working on it.
Yes, well, you'll have to work on it for a while. Okay. How did you reach out to get some sort of financial basis to operate on?
Yeah, that's a good question. The group, so this was, they were kind of helping this. They brought me on to help do some coordination, like convening stakeholders to better understand.
You'd worked in the field. I mean, in the field of coordinating and management.
I had coordinator, I think, was attached to every job I had held previous to this. But they were working closely with Community Futures in Vernon and connecting to the regional district of the North Okanagan. And, you know, there may be some miscommunication about the amount of money that we thought Land to Table might get over time, but the regional district has been actually quite supportive to get Land to Table up and running and gaining momentum in terms of helping to support that coordination time needed.
What would you say at that beginning phase of Land to Table, what was the main source of, whether it was money or organizational support, what really helped you get going?
It was the people and the relationships, really, always. I think one of the founding members, Mary Stockdale, Dr. Mary Stockdale, she's a prof at UBCO, her family had owned a farm in Enderby and had gone through its ups and downs, right? And she was seeing farms like her family's farm being lost. So her mentorship and her understanding of systems was key. Having some key organizations like Community Futures, and then also having some regional district electoral area directors who are connected to the places that have the most agricultural land, their understanding of why this was needed.
Did they sense that some of this land wasn't being, could be used in a more advantageous way, or?
They knew that the farmers on ALR land in particular were struggling for a number of reasons, and they knew that that was connected to provincial policy in some cases, not in all cases.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to know, and this is a little bit of a sidebar, but I think it's an important one. How many of the original group were women as opposed to men?
All of them.
Okay. I guess I kind of knew that answer. Uh-huh. Because there is a trend, which I think is very, very powerful and very positive, and that is for women such as yourself with qualifications, with experience, and also inspiration and a desire to work, and in fact, greater skills at working collaboratively, not competitively, but collaboratively, to become part of this kind of resurgence of rehabilitating both society and our relationship with the terra firma that we're resting on. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about that? Because I think it's something I've mentioned it before in the show, and I think it's a really important thing. So I want you to...
Yeah. Oh, I feel like I could probably talk about this one for a long time. It almost feels emotional.
Well, it should, because it's a powerful thing. That's a shift. It's a shift.
Well, and I feel like I have been very lucky in my life to have a lot of very strong women leaders to learn from. So I think probably a lot of women who are my counterpart in this role, food systems work or environmental work, have had the same privilege. So there's that. We aren't doing this alone. It's, you know, we're on the backs of many giants women before us. Yeah. 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 Giants, whatever. Yeah. But I think that all of the women who I work with care deeply and are deeply connected to their places and their communities and their families, and not doing this work isn't an option. Like, it's just in us, and it's driven. But I'll tell you, the thing that gets me is what some might refer to as the nonprofit industrial complex, right? Mm-hmm, like how mm-hmm, this work mm-hmm. began on the backs of women who couldn't work and so volunteered their time to fill in the gaps and close the injustices.
Yes, it's interesting how a number of nonprofits, probably the majority, have men as people at the head and then women who are actually doing the work. But it's I can tell you that the executive director of Canadian Association of Physicians, the last two who've been significant in the organization have been women. And right now the staff it's up to 17, I think, and I would say 7/8 of them are women.
Right.
And that's a demographic shift, if you want to call it, from its founding when we had mostly males and the board was mostly male.
Yeah.
And now the board itself is also mostly women.
Yeah.
And I think this is a very important sea change.
Sure. And I don't want it to be exclusive, but women's only club, you know.
No. But it's a change in emphasis that is opening doors for women with particular skills and aptitudes that women have that men struggle to attain.
I can tell you a quick little story. This is something that happened recently that made me smile and chuckle inside. I was at a conference and I was talking to the director of an organization, very amazing leader of a man who's well-respected in his field. And him and I were talking to another woman. And he said, you know, we've tried to collaborate with lots of organizations over the years, but Land to Table is the only one that it's really worked with. And I don't know, maybe that has something to do with Liz. Maybe that's just, maybe things are changing now. But I think it has to do everything with the group of women who founded Land to Table and the kind of core mission of what we do and how we do it.
What did the other woman who was part of this conversation have to say about that?
I think she just smiled and nodded.
Wisely. Wisely in the sense she knew that there's a reason for it.
Yeah, and I think he was just recognizing something that we feel very proud of at Land Table and the work that we do.
Long ago, there was an organization in Vancouver that did polling and surveys, and they repeatedly did surveys of who is most concerned about environmental degradation and wants to do something about it. And it was women with young children.
Yeah.
The sector of society that cares the most about this is very clearly defined. And I think it's something that, you know, if we had a statue in front of City Hall that wasn't a guy wearing armor on a horse, but a woman holding her child, I think we might make some useful progress in the world. Now you do have some funding.
Yeah.
Why don't you just run through? I've got some of the names here. Maybe you can just tell.
Gosh.
You can tell me what they've done. So the North Okanagan Regional District.
Yeah. You know, again, talking about leadership, the electoral area directors in particular, right? As I mentioned, they're the ones who represent constituents who are living on the agricultural land. Mm-hmm. They've been so supportive of Land to Table over the years.
In more than just financial.
Yeah. They really believe in the work in terms
lifting
of
lifting levers and stuff like
agricultural
that.
Agricultural economic development. Yeah. Paving the way. Partnerships. We're partnering with two electoral area directors on the BX Ranch Lands Development Plan project right now. It's an agricultural park to invite community access to the land to grow more food. Yeah.
United Way. Now, the United Way is interesting because you actually did a sort of course with their Public Policy Institute.
Yeah, that's right.
But obviously, they're also helping out with Land to Table as well.
United Way has been the funder who has really allowed us to grow. We are, for the past 3 years, we've been a regional community food hub through United Way funding through that initiative. And it's allowed us, it's the funding that's allowed us to hire a coordinator. So I'm not a one-woman show anymore. It's two of us women. And
Well, I should mention the program in Vermont has five.
Yeah.
For the whole program, okay. You know, with a budget of $6 million.
I should say we have two. We also have a part-time communications coordinator, also a young woman. So anyway.
So what about the Public Health Association of BC?
Yeah.
Interesting sort of a health angle, which is always a powerful thing to bring into it.
Yeah. So this is where partnership is so powerful. We've been partnering with the Public Health Association of BC to help us to share a communications coordinator, actually. So they house this coordinator who mostly works for the farm to school program, and we pay into that and get some land to table hours. Yeah.
Yeah, the Public Health Association be very active in the school food program. That's one of their babies.
You had Sonia Rokosh on, who's one of their school food animators, an amazing leader.
Interior health. Interior health is an interesting large bureaucracy that I deal with on a regular basis. Well, how have you found them?
Well, again, at that local relational level, they've been fantastic. Mm. Linda Boyd, a public health dietitian at Interior Health, has been one of our founding members on the board. Mm. So I think, and the point there is through Linda's guidance, but also through grants that we've received from them over the years, we're able to make that connection between food security and growing the local food economy, providing nutritious access to local food. Access to nutrition.
Now, you've already mentioned UPCO because one of the core members of the circle that's...
Yes.
Why don't you talk about what they've done?
Yeah, UPCO has, again, another really powerful partnership. We've been working closely with them through the Institute for Community Engaged Research. So that's Mary Stockdale and John Corbett. We've been able to develop what is now year three of a local food procurement pilot project. They've got some really passionate people who care about how their food is grown and where it comes from. And so they're testing on an institutional level how we get food from small and medium scale farmers. So we're working with a farmer in the North Okanagan who's aggregating product from many small farms in order to get the volume of food that UBCO needs.
Getting the system.
Creating the system.
Is such an important
thing. It's one of the first steps that we've taken to help develop that system.
Now, you've got to know a little bit about the Shoe Shop Food Action Society, Serena and Melanie and all the others.
Yeah.
What role? They're another on-the-ground group that's doing some of the stuff that you're planning about, but they're actually doing it on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot, Serena and I, Melanie and Howie and I, the last year in particular, because I think that we're working towards the same goals, but our approach is a little bit different.
Sure.
They run some amazing food programming that's doing a beautiful job of connecting the local food economy to food security. Again, it's that connection because it's not one piece at a time. It's
that's
a system.
Right. Okay.
And so we're talking about how we can collaborate more in the future through infrastructure, through shared programming, maybe even through shared positions to improve or increase the impact.
Now we're getting near the end of the show today, but I wanted to just tuck in a couple of other groups. Feed BC.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Feed BC has been, I'm laughing because it's again, relationships. Mm. They have helped fund the UBCO work over time. They also funded a market opportunity study that Land to Table undertook last year. And so they're helping us to kind of fill these knowledge gaps and fill these coordination gaps.
Finally, Kwantlen College.
Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Yes. Yeah. So
I gave their old name.
You did. Yeah, right. We've been working closely with the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems. The amazing thing about ISFS, that institute, is that they're really good at research and they're really good at data collection. And I'm not very good at that. And so we can partner on these projects that help fill knowledge and data gaps.
And who's your main contact there?
I work really closely with Christy Tadaby, who's an amazing food systems, security leader, but also Kent Mullenix, who's the director of the Institute there.
We're going to be having Kent on the show in sometime in the near future. So
that's great.
I wanted to, I was sort of massaging the information a little bit
to
bring around to that corner. But I mean, the Kwantlen College is also involved with the Journal of Food Systems, Community and something else in Community Development, which is a wonderful journal that would be the kind of journal that would actually talk about the story of Land to Table.
Yeah, okay.
If they haven't done it already.
And they've done bioregion studies
where
they're trying to
stuff.
Understand it's our food self-sufficiency needs and how to be more food secure.
It's a fabulous publication. And and has led me and our show to various, you know, guests who have played a very big role in that system through the journal. The journal is at being our link.
Yeah.
Well, we're pretty much there. It's been wonderful having you on the show, Liz.
So fun. Thank you.
It's part of a nexus of issues that are coming together now. Community development, food, relationship, collaboration. I mean, all these words we've used today, they are very much part of the kind of changes taking place away from competition and distant relationships.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about it. I love this stuff.
Well, I'm thinking we might have you back to talk more about what Land to Table is actually doing on a day-to-day basis, because we talked about the origin story and we got right up to the present day, but I think there's more to talk about there. So if one day you'd be able to come back, we'd be delighted.
Absolutely. Sounds great. Thanks again.
It's a pleasure.